You know, there are appointed times. There are 7 annual Sabbaths. We just kept the Feast of Tabernacles, in which there were 7 days, and then also another high day, the 8th day, which is holds a lot of meaning. Well, there are other numbers in Scripture that we can look at. There are things we can examine. One of the things we can examine is the 8th temple. But we'll have to go through the rest to get to the 8th. What do I mean by the 8th temple? Well, we hear of scholars talking about the first temple, the second temple, and even one to come. So how can we talk about a prophesied 8th temple? Well, to start, we'll need to go to the first one, the heavenly tabernacle. And of course, you may remember, going back, Moses was given a pattern that he was to follow from what was shown from heaven, the tabernacle there. We read of, the author of Hebrews, who gets into the idea of the Melchizedek order versus the Levitical order, gives clarification of that, and certainly he would have had the record of Moses being shown the pattern. He says in Hebrews 8, 1 through 2, now the main point is, in what has been said is this: we have such a high priest who has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in the heavens, a minister in the sanctuary and in the true tabernacle, which Yahweh pitched, not man. Hebrews 9:24. For Messiah did not enter a holy place made with hands, a mere copy of the true one, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of Elohim for us. And so without going over a lot of the details of Levitical versus Melchizedek, we understand, I think, the basics of that. There's some more that we could probably dig into at another time for another study. But this would be number one in our count. Now, this doesn't have to be number one. We could count from the earthly tabernacle. We could talk about the 7 temples on earth. But I want to go over all 8. So in doing so, we need to talk about the second one, which would be the earthly tabernacle. In Exodus 27, verse 9, it says, you shall make the court of the tabernacle. On the south side there shall be hangings for the court, a fine twisted linen, 100 cubits long for one side. Now it goes into much more detail. I don't want to bog us all down with the details. However, we can measure this out via cubits. And a cubit is understood to be about 18 inches, like from the elbow to your wrist, about a foot and a half. A reed, just thinking about reeds, would be 6 cubits, translated into our, in looking at how a reed would be used. So 6 cubits would be 18 times 6, or 108 inches, or 9 feet. Now this will all come into play a little bit later as we look at the sizes. And what we'll see is the sizes increase, at least with the earthly. I don't know if you can measure the one the one up above. But you know, we know that the earth is Yahweh's footstool. I mean, it's hard for us to grasp the magnitude of Yahweh and who he is and all that he's doing. But we do get a sense of growth as we go through these. And so, not to spend a lot of time on the earthly tabernacle, but that would be second in line. We can go into Solomon's temple, which is typically understood as the first temple, the brick and mortar type of temple. But in 2 Chronicles 3:3, it says, now these are the foundations which Solomon laid for building the house of Yahweh. The length in cubits, according to the old standard, was 60 cubits, and the width 20 cubits. It's measured basically 90 by 30, with courts 600 to 300 feet, this making the overall size larger than the original tabernacle. Of course, the tabernacle was, you know, used within the wilderness. It was kind of a portable type tent, essentially, but it's something they could unfold, put up together, and have, you know, worship and have the high priest go into the Holy of Holies and these type of things. And of course, you know, there's a lot more details there. I don't want to get into too much of the details today. Just want to get an overview of the eight temples. Now, Solomon's temple took time to build. 1 Kings 6:38. In the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the eighth month, the house was finished throughout all its parts and according to all its plans. So he was 7 years building it. Now, the interesting thing about this is you go into chapter 7, and then he spends like 13 years making his own house. And it's like double the size of Yahweh's house, which was interesting. So, he followed the plans that he had, and then he decided to build one that was larger for himself. Of course, he had concubines and wives, and he also multiplied horses, and these were things that he wasn't supposed to do, and they caused problems for him. And a number of the scholars don't think he's actually going to make it, because he's spoken to at least a couple times by Yahweh, and he ended up making altars for his foreign wives and allowed them to worship Molech and these pagan deities, and it just was wrong for him to allow. We can look at that at another time, but 1 Kings 6:38, in the 11th year in the month of Bul, he did this, putting it together, this temple. 7 years in the making. And, you know, the number seven, we can think of completeness, spiritual perfection, these type of things. Completeness, at least for the temple. Let's go on to Zerubbabel's temple. Ezra 5:2. Then Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, and Joshua the son of Zadok arose and began to rebuild the house of Yahweh, which is in Jerusalem, and the prophets of Yahweh were with them, supporting them. So this is basically built on that ground, essentially, same spot. Zechariah 4:9, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this house, and his hands will finish it. Then you will know that Yahweh of hosts has sent me to you. What we see is actually Yahweh building the temple in Ezra 1:1. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of Yahweh by the mouth of Jeremiah, Yahweh stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, the king of Persia, so he sent a proclamation throughout all of his kingdom, and he put it in writing, and that continues, and we have the record of that. And this actually took 20 years to build, when you look at the timing of it. Now, this tends to lead into, and I should mention, this would be number four, but this is four part one, in the sense of looking at what Herod did. Herod basically built up this temple, built it up, expanded it, built a stronger foundation for it. And we can look at Josephus and see some of what was said about that. It concerned the Jews, actually, because they thought, this is way too massive of a structure. You know, how is it going to be supported and all this? They were a little concerned about it, as a historical record gives. But going into John 2:20. This being Herod's temple, but again, it's a rebuilding of Zerubbabel's temple. So it's a building of it. John 2:20. The Jews then said, it took 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days. So we see progression with the temples also taking more time. This one, 46 years. So you can imagine, if Solomon's temple was great, and it was, this one must have been that much more in putting it together. But the works of Josephus mentions that they, that is the Jews, were afraid that he would pull down the whole edifice and not be able to bring his intentions to perfection for its rebuilding. And this danger appeared to them to be very great, and the vastness of the undertaking to be such as could hardly be accomplished. But while they were in this disposition, the king encouraged them and told them he would not pull down their temple till all the things were gotten ready for the building it up entirely again. And he promised them this beforehand, so he did not break his word with them, but got ready 1,000 wagons and were to bring in stones for the building, and chose out 10,000 of the most skillful workmen and brought 1,000 sacerdotal ornaments for as many of the priests. I'm assuming that would have been like some of the ivory pomegranates. They found one over in that area in Jerusalem. They had some of them taught the art, or some of them were taught the arts of the stone cutters and other carpenters, and then began to build. But this not until everything was well prepared for the work. So we see that from the first tabernacle on, the sizes have been increasing, the times have been increasing, you know, to build these. Well, what's coming is much greater in scope and magnitude than I think any of us have really considered before. But before we go there, do we often think that we ourselves are the temple of Yahweh? Speaks of this in Scripture. 1 Corinthians 3:16-17, do you not know that you are the temple of Elohim, and that the Spirit of Yahweh dwells in you? If any man destroys the temple of Yahweh, Yahweh will destroy him. For the temple of Yahweh is holy, and that is what you are. This would be number 5. You know, I didn't have time this morning. I probably should have put the numbers down before each section. Maybe make it a little bit more clear. But when we think of the temples, and we'll give a listing here at the end, this temple, our temple, that is collectively as a body of Messiah, being a temple unto Yahweh and unto Yahshua as a dwelling place, that would constitute as a temple. And you know, when the Spirit is placed within us, it goes deep within us, just as the Spirit of Yahweh went deep into the Holy of Holies. A portion of His Spirit, a part of Himself, goes into the core of who we are. We don't have the fullness, not like Yahshua had the fullness. He could walk through walls if He wanted to. But you know, when we think of how important it is to take care of our temples, you know, we can think of Aaron's sons, Nadab, Abihu, in Leviticus 9:24. They had sin, they had corruption. They were killed. And so if we continue in sin and corruption, have unclean things come into us, and we do so willfully and arrogantly, then it's to ask the Shekinah glory of Yahweh to leave. It's that important, because things in the past we know of, well, if we're likened to the temple, we need to be very careful about how we walk the walk, not just talking the talk. But Nadab and Abihu died, and so will all those who defile the temple of Yahweh, as clearly Scripture talks about. 1 Peter 2:5, you also as living stones are being built up as a spiritual house for a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to Yahweh through Yahshua the Messiah. And under the Melchizedek order, we do this, this priestly order. But under the Levitical order, it's not so much spiritual, it's more physical. And those of us with the Spirit of Yahweh within, at the Messiah's return, will be changed fully into spirit beings. But in the meantime, we offer up spiritual sacrifices still through Him as a high priest. And we did this even this morning, but with praise from our lips. It's a spiritual sacrifice. It's a sacrifice to do certain physical things, attending the feast. I mean, when we talk about the Feast of Tabernacles, if you're not familiar with the seven annual holy days and times, these appointed times, they are forever. There is no time period in which they stop. You know, they didn't stop in the first century. They certainly didn't stop in times past, and it's not going to stop in the future. And we have prophecies that talk about curses coming upon those that would refuse to do these things in the future. So there would be even curses now to refuse to do these things now. It's one thing to be ignorant. It's another thing to just refuse what Yahweh tells us to do. I'm reminded of Joshua, who, you know, on the stake said, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." Yet they put him to death. I mean, we all put him to death. So, you know, Yahweh's very merciful, and, you know, all judgment's going to be given to the Son. So his judgment, I think, is going to be very merciful. But for those that are willfully obstinate and rebellious, I mean, we can look at Korah's rebellion and different things, and we see how Yahweh dealt with them. Well, we know that there's mercy, but how has it been said? Mercy ends with judgment. It's a true statement. And so we understand some of these things, and certainly as we move forward, we should be introspective of these things. Okay, number six, a temporary tabernacle before Yahshua's return. Matthew 24 and verse 12. "Because lawlessness is increased," that is disobedience, both against man's law and Yahweh's, for that matter, "but most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. The evangel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." And what does this have to do with the temple? Well, or tabernacle. Well, we'll get into the next verses and we'll see. But just thinking about Matthew 24 and the basically, it's a basic outline of what's coming. First, he says, don't be deceived. Then he says, you know, things are going to get bad. There's going to be rumors of wars. Don't worry about it. There's still things to come. We get down to, you know, lawlessness has increased. And we think about, you know, as in the times of Moses, you know, as in the times of Lot, do we see those times today? Do we see lawlessness increase? I think we do. And I think it's just getting worse. But going on here in Matthew 24, 15 through 16, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains." Someone was just asking earlier today, where, you know, what happens when all this stuff comes about? Do we flee? Well, if you can run, if it's appropriate, run. But, you know, things are going to happen, and where are you going to run to? It's going to be worldwide, the tribulation that's coming. "However, those in Judah are told to flee." Now, they're told to flee after they see this abomination of desolation set up. Well, we understand that's in the Holy of Holies, and some relate it to us. I'm not sure how that's going to happen, because Yahweh's spirit and evil don't mix. And so I think this is literally going to be some sort of tabernacle that's set up. Not necessarily a physical, you know, brick and mortar type of temple, but a temporary tabernacle. I mean, they can take the one out of the Negev desert and put it up on the Temple Mount if they blow that mosque up. And not that they're going to do that, not that I would recommend that, don't want to advocate you know, that, but something may happen to where they'll get the opportunity to start implementing sacrifices, and they're ready. I think they've been in training, they've got the implements, they've spent at least hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, on the gold and stuff for the lavers and the menorah and these type of things. We have a family here that just went to Israel. Maybe you saw some of these things while you were there. I think some are available to see in you know, the respectful locations. But they have priests, kohanim, I think is the term, kohanim, anyway, they've looked at the genes and they've identified them, and I don't know all the details of that, but evidently they're ready to go. But it's for those specifically in Israel that are told to flee to the mountains, not us necessarily over here, those in Judea. So Petra has been pointed to, there's another mountain location north, I think, whereas Petra would be south. You know, the Messianic Jews, which I believe are up around 20,000 now in Israel. I've heard numbers, they keep growing. Last number I heard was 15,000 or so. I'm sure it's up to 20 now, if not more. But they would be the ones reading the Brit Ha Kadesh. Am I saying that right, Vincent?
The New Testament?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, as you can tell, I don't speak Hebrew, but I'm learning, so a little bit here and there. But they would be the ones seeing that, and they would be the ones to know, hey, Yahshua said, get out of here, so we're going to go. And there may be some others over there. There's Christians over there, part of the northern tribes, no doubt. They may follow them and as well. But we'll see. But when you read Revelation 12, and you have Israel in mind, northern and southern tribes, and you can see the Messiah there related. I mean, a lot of people pointed to September the 23rd as being, you know, that's Revelation 12. Well, no, it goes much deeper than that. It's not just, you know, stars. It's talking about Israel. And the promises to Israel was to be a multitude of stars, you know, that no man can count, as well as, you know, physical sand. So people, spiritual and physical, I think are being related when you look at some of those things, some of the promises. And those promises come over to us in Messiah. And so we have a circumcision of heart and, you know, identifying sign and seal, so to speak, with all of that. But let's see. So we're looking at the temporary tabernacle. So I guess essentially we can go into the seventh. The seventh, Ezekiel 42. Now here we really start to move up in size, and we're going to take a look at how that's going to be. But it has to do with some of the reeds and the measurements. And we'll take a look at that. Ezekiel 42, 15 through 17. Now when he had finished measuring the inner house, he brought me out. Now this is prophecy to Ezekiel. And I say prophecy because even though, you know, out of the Babylonian captivity, they ended up going back, Zerubbabel didn't build the temple like this. And they must have realized, I can only assume, they must have realized that this is going to be for a future time. And how this is going to be put together, at the exact time, I don't know, but it's prophecy. This is like thinking of the prophecy in Ezekiel 37, is it, where it talks about the Gog of Magog coming down, or is that 38? But in that, you know, how could that have happened without Israel being in the land and established state? I mean, it's a start. It's not complete by any measure, but it allows prophecy to take place. You know, before 1948, how could that prophecy have taken place? But now that's happened. So just because we don't understand how something can be doesn't mean we neglect the prophecy, because we understand these are inspired words from Yahweh, though written down by man's hands. It's ultimately Yahweh's hands that have put this together for us and have inspired the words we see in black and white. But Ezekiel 42, 15 through 17, now when he had finished measuring the inner house, he brought me out by the way of the gate which faced toward the east and measured it all around. He measured on the east side with the measuring reed 500 reeds by the measuring reed. He measured it on the north side 500 reeds by the measuring reed. Going on 18 through 20, on the south side he measured 500 reeds. You're looking in your scriptures, might say cubits. Interesting. On the south side, he measured 500 reeds with the measuring reed. He turned to the west side, measured 500 reeds with the measuring reed. He measured on four sides. It had a wall around, length 500 and the width 500, and to divide between the holy and the profane. Okay, I want to take you to a conservative commentary. And we could actually take a look at a couple, but let's just look at Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. It says concerning 500 reeds for Ezekiel 42:16 and such here, says the Septuagint substitutes cubits for reeds. They made an addition. They couldn't believe it. Reeds can't be reeds, has to be cubits. This thing is way, way too big. Not necessarily. Says for reeds to escape the immense compass assigned to the whole, namely a square of 500 rods or 3,000 cubits. And that would be essentially 2 feet each, if we look at Ezekiel 45, which we will do. But it says, and in all a square of 1 1/7 miles squared, essentially, for the temple area. That is more than all ancient Israel. Also, there is much space thus left unappropriated. You must be thinking about the priestly area, the Levitical area, the area for the priests, so on. But Fairborn rightly supports the English version, which agrees with the Hebrew. The vast extent is another feature marking the ideal character of the temple. It symbolizes the great enlargement of the kingdom. End quote. So thinking about 3,000 cubits at 2 feet each. Ezekiel 40 verse 5, it says, and behold, there was a wall on the outside of the temple all around, and in the man's hand was a measuring rod of 6 cubits, each of which was a cubit and a handbreadth. So from the elbow to not stopping here, but going out to, Carrie, can we pull it? Yeah, out to from the elbow, not stopping here, but actually going a handbreadth. So this is a full 2 feet that we're looking at. And this is how they would measure, kind of like how we might walk on the, you know, and measure each foot out, which is, you know, fairly accurate. But going back here, it says, and a handbreadth, so you measure the thickness of the wall, 1 rod, and the height, 1 rod. I'll just give you a little comment here about this 3,000 cubits. We've been asked recently about the Book of Enoch. Now, the Book of Enoch, in chapter 7 and verse 2, talks about the sons of Elam, sons of Elohim, essentially having relationships with physical women and producing 3,000 cubit tall children. Do you see where I'm going with this? When we measure, when we translate this into feet, we're talking over 5,000 feet. So, you know, some of the books that we have today, though, there's actually, there was Enoch. He evidently did write. And a lot of the, you know, there's 5 books of Enoch sectioned out that we could see. And there's very various ones. In the very first part, chapter 1, it looks very legitimate. I mean, it looks like it could have been taken from an original. But when you get into the rest of Enoch, even though it uses Yahweh's name, a lot of the scholars think it's just pseudographical in nature, apocryphal, associated to an actual author, but not the actual author. And they would have done things like this to sell books. Now, the Book of Enoch was in the Dead Sea Scrolls, so that's interesting. Did they save it because it had Yahweh's name in it? We just don't know. But the idea of a 5,000-foot individual, it seems a little unlikely. So I'm just throwing that out there. One of the reasons the Book of Enoch was brought up recently is because they were trying to prove a point of a doctrine, but we don't establish doctrines with extra biblical books. We understand the scriptures is inspired. There's some question about these extra books, like Jasher and such. I mean, yes, there was Jasher, he evidently wrote, but are the books that we have today from those individuals actually from those individuals, or are they copies? I kind of throw that out there. It's kind of interesting, as I was searching through this, found that I had heard that Enoch had mentioned 4,000 feet, but it's actually over 5,000 when you look at the cubit and a hand breadth in the measurement of all this. Okay, now this would be the temple with the outer courts a mile squared. And what might that look like? Well, E.W. Bullinger in the Companion Bible has looked at this, and he agrees with the Hebrew rather than the Greek, that the Hebrew wording is correct in mentioning a reed rather than the Greek mentioning a cubit. And so he sides with that, and he goes over the outer court, inner court, and then the temple and the altar and all that there. And that's Appendix 88, if you wanted to look at that. In fact, I think we have a copy of the Bullinger's Bible here, so you could just make a copy of Appendix 88. It goes more than just one section or one page here, because it gets into more. But this is an increase in size. This is the kingdom, or the temple's expanding. And of course, this would be a prophesied temple for the coming kingdom. Why would it be so big? I mean, in Zechariah 1:16, it says, "Therefore, thus says Yahweh." Well, in fact, we had read more than all of ancient Israel, but here it says, Zechariah 1:16, "Therefore, thus says Yahweh, I will return to Jerusalem with compassion. My house will be built in it, declares Yahweh of hosts, and a measuring line will be stretched over Jerusalem." This has yet to be done yet. Zerubbabel didn't follow these plans. Joshua hasn't returned. These dimensions are quite remarkable, so remarkable that the translators thought, no reeds. It has to be cubits, but it's reeds, I do believe. And I think the Hebrew is certainly where the rubber meets the road as far as truth. But and when we look at the rest of Ezekiel's vision concerning the coming kingdom, we see the Messiah has entered, but we know this hasn't happened yet. And we also find instructions for blood sacrifices, burnt offerings, but under the Levitical priesthood. Now, what we understand is there's going to be a physical people going into the coming kingdom. Revelation 7, multitude which no man can count. That may be talking about Israel taken from all the different nations and such, but there's going to be other nations, essentially not maybe knowing about Messiah, not knowing about Yahweh's laws and such. They're going to have to be instructed. Ezekiel 43:13-14. And these are the measurements of the altar by cubits, a cubit being a cubit and a handbreadth. The base shall be a cubit, and the width a cubit, and its border on its edge round about one span. And this shall be the height of the base of the altar. From the base of the ground to the lower edge shall be two cubits, and width one cubit. From the smaller ledge to the larger ledge shall be four cubits, and the width one cubit. Going on 15-17, the altar hearth shall be four cubits. From the altar hearth shall extend upwards four horns. Now the altar hearth shall be 12 cubits long by 12 wide, square in its four sides. Notice cubits are mentioned. Cubits are what is related in the Hebrew for this section. And there's a point that's to be made with that. It says the ledge shall be 14 cubits long to 14 wide in its four sides. The border shall it border around it shall be a half a cubit, and its base shall be a cubit round about, and its steps shall face the east. Okay. Here is a computer rendition of what this would be like, comparative to Solomon's altar, which is very close. Now, the idea that this is appropriate for men to walk up on and be there would give more indication that the physical sacrifices may indeed be implemented. Now, I'm not saying they have to be. We leave prophecy open for, you know, discussion, and hasn't happened yet, so, I mean, who am I to say how it's going to end up being exactly? But, you know, when we look at the details that are given about this temple, it's more than all the other details given about all the other temples. I mean, there's something to be said about that. When we look in sections of Scripture, and Yahweh has an entire a number of things mentioned on a subject, I mean, it's worth paying attention to. So, as we go on here, we see in Ezekiel 43:18-19, he said to me, "Son of man, thus says Yahweh Elohim, these are the statutes for the altar on the day it is built, to offer burnt offerings and to sprinkle blood on it. You shall give to the Levitical priests who are from the offspring of Zadok, who draw near to me to minister to me, declares Yahweh Elohim, a young bull for a sin offering." Now, the sons of Zadok, I mean, why would they be drawing close to Yahweh? Well, they were on Yahweh's side previously, whereas the rest of the Levitical priests tended to go to the wayside. So they're being brought in a little bit closer to Yahweh in the overall aspect of what we see in Ezekiel. And we did a whole commentary series about this, so if you want more, it's all recorded and online. And I have to admit, I had a lot of growth in just studying through this, and there were some mistakes. I made sure I corrected those mistakes as I saw them as mistakes. But there may be more, and I'm sure there is more. In fact, someone had put together, there's three ring binders back there that take up at least two shelves on just the book of Ezekiel. So it's, and I haven't read through those, but it uses the names, and I think it was a baptized individual that put them together. But nevertheless, going on here, verses 20 through 22, "You shall take some of its blood, put on the four horns, four corners of the ledge, and on the border around about it. Thus you shall cleanse it and make atonement for it. You shall also take a bull for the sin offering. It shall be burned at the appointed place of the house outside the sanctuary. On the second day you shall offer a male goat without blemish for a sin offering, and they shall cleanse the altar, and they cleanse it with the bull." Verses 23 through 25, "Then you have when you have finished cleansing it, you shall present a young bull without blemish, a ram without blemish on the flock. You shall present them before Yahweh. The priest shall throw salt on them. They shall offer them up as a burnt offering to Yahweh. For 7 days you shall prepare daily a goat for a sin offering, also a young bull and a ram for the flock without blemish shall be prepared." Now, it's important to point out that this is Yahweh talking to Ezekiel. I was looking recently at the vision where Moses and Elijah were seen with the risen Messiah, but this was before he died. Again, that's a vision for something for the future. It wasn't that Elijah and Moses were alive at that time. As we understand it, they were translated, well, Elijah and Elisha were translated into different areas. Moses, of course, wasn't able to go into the Promised Land. But it appears that the patriarchs will be brought into the coming kingdom, physical reign of 1,000 years, with Yahshua being there. But there's going to be physical people. There's going to be spiritual people, just like the promise to Abraham. Sands of the sea, stars of the heaven, these type of things. Am I right? You can question me. That's okay. It's just what we see at this point. So I don't want to get into an argument about it. In fact, the less arguments, the better. We had such a tremendous Feast of Tabernacles this year. It was the most peaceful I've ever been to. And that is no joke. And John Reese was made a deacon this year. As a requirement to be an elder, he has to be a deacon for a year. But he said that he was told by a couple others, so two or three witnesses, you know, things are to be established, but he got the same response from others saying, this is the most peaceful, bar none. So it was wonderful. And it was needed, I think. Because we go through a lot of stress with people contacting us. Not everyone wants to hear what we have to say. They want to tell us what they have to say. Well, okay, I'll listen for a little bit. But there's been times when it just comes down to, you know, we just have to agree to disagree, or it's obvious that there's an anti-Messiah spirit involved, or, you know, they're just maybe we don't fully understand, so we have to continue studying. It's not always black and white, and so, you know, we continue to study and learn and grow. I think that's what we're supposed to do. Grow in grace and knowledge of the Son. In the Aramaic, it also says of the Father, interestingly enough, in the Peshitta. So, different sources give a little bit, you know, maybe a better understanding, going back to the Aramaic, going back to the Hebrew. Looking at the name recently, and I brought a couple books, actually, showing the complexities of Hebrew and the grammatical situations and how words, you know, how Hebrew, the number of words have multiple meanings. I mean, a lot of them have multiple meanings. I also brought a book by Andrew Gabriel Roth talking about the name of Yahshua and such. And we actually had a rabbi confront one of our members, and he brought up Andrew Gabriel Roth in a long email and said, well, he's a you know, an expert in the Aramaic because he's raised up in the language. Well, if you're not raised up in the language, it can be very hard to study Aramaic. I heard one professor talking to his students, and he basically said, even if you study Aramaic for 25 years, you may not be as fluent in it as someone who was raised up in it. So there's some complexities there, nuances in the vocalization and such. And just my wife and I, we were looking at learning some Hebrew, and we found out that if you say one thing to a man in Hebrew, you better be prepared to say something different to a woman in the same thought, but different wording to mean the same thing. So it gets complex. But someone was basically approaching us with this other alternative name. We're seeing all these different names for the Father, different names for the Son. What's going on? Well, I think overnight we've had a bunch of scholars, Hebrew linguists, just rise up. It's amazing. It's a miracle. Or it's confusion. And I think we're seeing confusion. And we were contacted by someone recently. He said, you know, I've been understanding Yahweh's name and Yahshua's name and the truth for 30 years. And all of a sudden, in the last few years, it's just a big mess now out there. And so one of the reasons I brought these resources is just try to explain to this individual that's questioning about these different alternative names. You know, he's trying to understand it, but, you know, we default to the Hebrew linguist in our writings. And even recent questions about the various alternative names we've sent to the scholars, a Hebrew linguist at Oxford, Harvard, Yale, to have them address it, because I don't know Hebrew that well, if at all. I mean, I know just enough. I can look in an interlinear. I can look at a lexicon. I can kind of look at, but I'm, you know, as far as my understanding, it's, what was said, retarded compared to Elohim? So there's just some things that we have to default to the experts on. But we do see certain things that give clarification, and certainly when it comes into the Word, and the Word says that, you know, my name is in Him, listen to Him, He has inherited a name above all names. I mean, what's that telling us? So we can get into simple stuff like the Yod, meaning eh or ah, as it's written, and Andrew Gabriel Roth makes a case for it being Yah's salvation, Yahshua. So, I mean, that's some of the things. But I heard him recently, and he went back to saying Yeshua. I think it's getting mixed. It's like hearing some of these individuals mixing it up, because there's a broad spectrum of individuals, and they're used to hearing Lord God and Jesus and different things, Yeshua and Yahshua, and so they're kind of mixing it up. I don't necessarily believe that that's a good thing. I believe we're to be as pure as we can with the understanding that we've been given at this point. But going on here, it says in Ezekiel 43:23-27, "For 7 days thou shalt make atonement for the altar, purify it, so they shall consecrate it. When they have completed the days, it shall be on the eighth day and onward. The priest shall offer your burnt offerings on the altar," another reference to eighth day, "and your peace offerings I will accept you, declares Yahweh Elohim." And of course, for those 1,000 years, it's going to be test and trial, I suspect, and talks about different things we could look at in prophecy concerning that. But in Ezekiel 44:1-2, "Then he brought me back by the way of the outer gate of the sanctuary, which faces the east, and it was shut. Yahweh said to me, this gate shall be shut. It shall not be opened, and no one shall enter by it, for Yahweh Elohim of Israel has entered by it, therefore it shall be shut." Well, Yahweh, for some reason, is allowing those physical people to come into the kingdom to immediately accept, or is not allowing people to come in immediately accept Yahshua, as far as we can tell. Again, it's up for interpretation, but this we don't believe has happened, but yet it's prophesied, so we believe it will happen. But there's been some that say, well, Yahweh decided not to do this. Well, Yahweh doesn't change. You know, is he going to have all this written and then not do it? Yeah, we'll see. But we understand that this is the Messiah entering into the kingdom that's being spoken here. However, the Ancient of Days, that is Yahweh himself, won't come down until everything is purified. And that's after the 1,000-year reign, as we understand it. I mean, that's open for discussion as well. But essentially, everything will be purified before Yahweh comes down. And then we get into the process of Yahweh wiping away every tear, you know, new heaven, new earth, you know, everything is put away that was bad. And so it's a good thing to look forward to. But the expansiveness of the kingdom is well noted and even shocks those whom the prophecies are given. Zechariah 2:1-4. "Then I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, there was a man with a measuring line in his hand. So I said, where are you going? And he said to me, to measure Jerusalem, to see how wide it is and how long it is." If you can hear the excitement here. "And behold, the angel was speaking with me, was going out, and another angel was coming out to meet him and said to him, run, speak to that young man, saying, Jerusalem will be inhabited without walls because of the multitude of men and cattle within it." Again, why the cattle? Interesting. But when we take a look at the overall measurements that Bullinger has together, when we look at the numbers with the reed being used rather than the cubit, though with the altar it's used as a cubit for men to be able to be up on that. But the whole topography of this area will be changed. And we know that when Yahshua returns, he's going to step on the Mount of Olives. There's going to be a great valley. Things are going to move. Things are going to be changed. You know, it talks about old mountains will be laid low. There's figurative wording, you know, figurative understanding there as well. But I think physically as well, that's going to happen. So some interesting things coming. And this is based upon the, you know, for the lands with the Levites, priests, princes, etc., in the city and all that. But the temple will be essentially in the middle, and there's Jerusalem right in the middle of that. Now, let's back up to Ezekiel 44:23-24. We read, "Moreover, they shall teach my people the difference between holy and the profane, and cause them to discern between the unclean and the clean, In a dispute, they shall take their stand to judge. They shall judge it according to my ordinances. They shall also keep my laws, my statutes, and all my appointed feasts, and sanctify my Sabbaths. This is what's going to be expected of all the people coming into the coming kingdom. And I, you know, we have the opportunity to do it right now, and to learn, and to be blessed, to offer up spiritual sacrifices, to learn why these feasts, you know, what they represent, and to come out refreshed, to be able to help others, and to be joyful. It's a joyful time to come before Yahweh. And, you know, we get told to come out every week, like a cyclical pattern, and, you know, helps us to learn of His Word, helps us to keep in mind His ways throughout the week. But, you know, 6 days we work, but the seventh is holy unto Yahweh. So we come before Him as a holy convocation. It's a commanded time in which we come before Him. And there's other wording for the feast that talk about, you know, some of the scholarship talks about these are being rehearsals. Well, rehearsals for what? Rehearsals for the kingdom. How are you going to tell someone in the kingdom, you know, hey, this is the way you should walk. Walk there in it, and not having walked in it yourself. Well, did you keep these feasts? Yeah. Kept them. And you'll be blessed if you keep them as well. But there will be some that may not want to keep them. So it's just the way it is. Yep. That's just heard in the audience, no rain for them. And we'll take a look at that. But the physical people that are allowed to come into the kingdom are going to learn, and they are they're going to learn that they need to obey Yahweh. Isaiah 2, 3 through 4, and many peoples will come and say, let us go up to the mountain of Yahweh, to the house of the El of Jacob, that he may teach us concerning his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For the law will go forth from Zion, and the word of Yahweh from Jerusalem, and he will judge between the nations, plural, and will render decisions for many peoples, plural. And they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. These are physical people. Nation will not lift up sword against nation, and never again will they learn war. Only when Satan is released for a time at the end of the 1,000 years will he try to gather up some people, and evidently they'll feel that they're getting a rotten deal or something. I don't know how they could be convinced, but they'll be consumed with fire. Yahweh's not gonna have it. No more rebellion. And so all that's in Revelation 20 and 21 there, looking at the prophecies. But it says they will not learn war anymore. They will learn the way of Yahweh as we do today, you know, keeping the feast and his appointed times. Zechariah 14, 16 through 17. Then it will come about that any who are left in the nations that went against Jerusalem, this is after the tribulation, any that are left, well, men will be like rare, like gold of Ophir, I think it's mentioned. But there's going to be, you know, a number of people left. If you look at the numbers, you know, talks about a third, you know. If you look at maybe just a third left, well, a third out of 7.5 billion people, well, that's a good couple billion people. Maybe that's going to play into the physical, you know, going in, but I don't know. Okay, and it will be whichever family. Oh, let me back up here. Let's just reread it. Then it will come about that any who are left of all the nations that went against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King Yahweh of hosts and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. And it will be with whichever the families of the earth does not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King Yahweh of hosts, there will be no rain on them. 18 through 19. If the family of Egypt, okay, so much for the ideology that Israel is the only ones to obey Yahweh. Well, here's Egypt. Even if Egypt does not go up or enter, then no rain will fall upon them. It will be the plague with which Yahweh smites the nations who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. This will be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all nations. All will be required who do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. And this fits in with the end of Ecclesiastes. You know, all mankind, the whole duty of mankind is to be keeping the commandments of Yahweh and doing his will. It's just a standard that we are to live by. Well, people will learn. The people that are in the world today need to learn. Zechariah 14, 20 through 21. In that day there will be inscribed on the bells of the horses, holy to Yahweh. And the cooking pots to Yahweh's house will be like the bowls before the altar. Every cooking pot in Jerusalem and in Judah will be holy to Yahweh of hosts. And all who sacrifice, why would every cooking pot? Is there that many that are needed? Every cooking pot in Jerusalem and in Judah will be holy to Yahweh of hosts. And all who sacrifice will come and take of them and boil in them. And there will no longer be a Canaanite in the house of Yahweh of hosts in that day. Well, same principles for blessings or obedience or curses for, you know, disobedience. They're offered in the kingdom for us, same thing. This chapter of Zechariah also gives confirmation of what we've already seen in the book of Ezekiel, a study of chapter 40, 40 on gives at least a little doubt in my mind that the Messiah will be in the kingdom, and the physical people who did not accept him prior to entering will be offering physical sacrifices to learn. While the temple is not standing today, Jews are preparing in Jerusalem for the time when it will. They already have spent millions of dollars preparing for the priestly bowls and the gold utensils, as mentioned before. And all this to carry out physical sacrifices for the people and themselves. And it seems that the non-Messianic Jews may get their wish once the temple is built, or if this tabernacle is put up. And like I say, I mean, we're looking through glass darkly, so to speak. Some of these events we see, we know that Yahweh's word is inspired. We're trying to learn as much as we can to have a good understanding, but it's prophecy, so it hasn't happened yet. We'll see how it plays out. All right, without further ado, the eighth temple, Revelation 21, 1 through 2. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and there. First earth passed away, and there was no longer any sea. I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from Elohim, made ready as a bride adorned for her husband. Verses 3 through 4. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the tabernacle of Yahweh is among them, and he will dwell among them, and they shall be his people, and Yahweh himself will be among them. And he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death. There will no longer be any mourning or crying or pain, for the first things have passed away. Now, it says, quotations, behold, the tabernacle of Yahweh is among men. Well, remember the first tabernacle, temple, but this is the eighth one mentioned here in verse 3. As we'll see, this appears to be just a figure of speech. But let's take a look at Revelation 21, 15 through 16. The one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to measure the city and its gates and its walls. The city was laid out as a square. Now this is, again, we're talking about different sizes. This one is huge, quite massive. And so it's evidently spiritual, because a structure this big, as we'll see, I don't think it would be able to stand on its own. The one who spoke with me had a gold measuring rod to the measure the city and its gates and its walls. The city is laid out as a square, its length as great as the width. And he measured the city with the rod 1,500 miles. Its length, width, height are equal. 1,500 miles squared. Some think it may actually be more of a pyramid. Maybe the images of the Giza pyramids that give that to our minds, I'm not sure, but I think it's a square structure. But this structure is just huge. I mean, if we were to put this in a frame of reference, it would cover about 20 of the United States. 20 states would go from the top of America down to the bottom and out, if you put it right in the middle. And if you put it right in the middle, it actually wouldn't set flat, being that many many miles across. It would have to hover, most likely, instead of just being, because it like teeter-totter. I know there's a lot of the flat earth teachings going on out there. We're going to take a closer look at that and present something on that, I think, a little bit later. As others are having to do, believe it or not, I was just listening to Michael Heiser. He's a Hebrew linguist. He's had to address it from the Hebrew because these individuals are saying, well, there's 75 areas of scripture that prove that the earth is flat. Another astrophysics PhD individual, you haven't heard this yet? Oh yeah, it's coming. There's a PhD astrophysics individual who I've listened to for years. He's now having to address it from a scientific viewpoint. And there's all these other videos coming out, both for and against the flat earth idea. Pretty interesting, but basically they're saying there's a bowl covering the earth. You can't go around it. You can only go to this structure that's covering it. Well, I won't say any more about that, but of this structure, I do think we're looking at a spiritual structure, and as big as it is, we'll most likely be hovering above the ground. Revelation 21, 22 through 23. I saw no temple in it for Yahweh, in it, you know, so where's the eighth temple? Well, it may be better said that, or asked, who is the eighth temple? I saw no temple in it, for Yahweh Elohim, the Almighty, and the Lamb are its temple. And the city has no need for the sun or the moon to shine on it, for the glory of Yahweh has illuminated it, and its lamp is the Lamb. Okay, so, I mean, we could look at all the numbers. In fact, let me go ahead and put these up here. Eight temples in all. First one, heavenly tabernacle. Second one, earthly tabernacle. Third, Solomon's temple. Fourth, Zerubbabel's, which Herod built up and enlarged, or rebuilt and enlarged. Five, us as a dwelling place for Yahweh. Six, temporary tabernacle. Seventh, kingdom temple. And number eight, Yahweh and Yahshua. Just looking at the last two numbers, seven, completeness. It's a 1,000-year reign. And some look at this coming up in the seventh day in the sense of we've been on the earth 6,000 years. This next 1,000 years coming up would be 1,000-year millennial reign, number seven. But number eight, time out of time, eternity, the eighth day, which we just kept after the Feast of Tabernacles, represents eternity. We're looking at eternity after all of, you know, from the Yahshua's giving of his self, which Passover represents, all the way through through other meanings, right down to the time out of time, the eighth day. So again, I, you know, not saying this has to be the way it, you know, I presented it. It'd be looked at a little bit differently, but it's something to consider when we think about numbers, when we think about what Yahweh's doing, what he possibly could be having readied in the future. But one thing is for sure, obedience to his word. It's not, you know, like he says, this is not out of reach for you. This, you know, you can be blameless. Yahweh says, be blameless. But men say, oh, you can't be blameless. Men say, oh, you can't do that. Yahweh says, it's doable. So let's get in line with what Yahweh says rather than what man says. Eighth temple, amazing. Eight in total, as far as I can see. But it could be looked at a little bit differently. But the number eight is symbolic for eternal life. So that's something we are all looking forward to. Hallelujah.